Hello and welcome to the fifth season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and we're back with brand new weekly episodes where I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Since announcing this season on social media, I've had a lot of really nice comments from listeners and all your feedback is always appreciated. So if you'd like to send us a message, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week has forged an amazing career with the Royal Ballet Company, dancing some of the most prestigious roles on one of the world's greatest ballet stages. Claire Calvert was born in Bath and grew up learning to dance in the area. Making the decision as a teenager to join White Lodge, the Royal Ballet's boarding school in London, she hasn't looked back and has since become a first soloist with the company, dancing major roles in productions of Sleeping Beauty, The Nutcracker, Swan Lake and many more. We met earlier this month in London and talked about all aspects of life as a professional dancer, the mental and emotional elements of performing, and the resilience of coming back from injury. Claire, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Hi.
I think this might be the first podcast that I've recorded outside of Somerset.
Ah, amazing.
So thank you for taking the time. We're in the Royal Opera House,
yeah.
Which is why there might be some announcements kind of going on, stage calls, that kind of thing. And we are kind of in the early performances of a run of Sleeping Beauty at the moment. So what does a typical day look like?
Typical day. We always have our routine ballet class in the morning, which is our, you know, warm up for the day, really. I guess when you are starting out your career, ballet class is much about learning steps and progressing in that way. But when you get into company life, you know, you use it for what you need to. If you're going to be rehearsing for 6 hours after, you're not going to kill yourself in ballet class. We start with that at 10:30 till 11:45, and then we have a 15-minute break before we start rehearsals, which can go from 12 through to 6:30, sometimes with or without breaks, dependent on how busy you are. And like a really large range of rep as well, because even though Sleeping Beauty is on at the moment, we still need to keep rehearsing it in between shows, but also we're preparing for Wolfworks, which opens afterwards. We're also started rehearsals for Cinderella, which opens after that. So, you know, there's always such an overlap of what we're doing. If there's a show, the rehearsals only go to 5:30, and then we have a 2-hour break, which you have to fit in eating, sleeping, doing your makeup, rewarming up, putting your costume on to be down on stage at 7:30 to start the show. And most shows, whether they're a full-length story ballet or a triple bill or double bill, they're usually in and around the 2.5 to 3 hour mark. So we're sort of cutting down 10:30 at night, up to the changing room, shower, take all your makeup off, everything, get home pretty late and do it all again. So it is quite a rigorous day.
Pretty full on.
Yeah.
You're dancing the Lilac Fairy, which is a role that you're reprising. That was your principal debut here as well.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Does that have a special significance for you, dancing that role?
Definitely is, a very special role. And being the sort of latter side of my career now, it's something that I look back on and I think, wow, I was very young when I first did it. I was an artist in the company and obviously we don't do it every year, but you know, I've been in the company 16 years now, and so it's sort of like 13, 14 years since I did it, and that's like a long time. So she still has her challenges, but yeah, it's a very special role for me.
And for those people who might be listening and don't know the world of ballet very well, they're not all equal, the fairies, are they?
No.
The Lilac Fairy is sort of
She's
one.
Sort of, I guess, because what people might know, the Disney fairy tale, there's the fairy godmother. And I guess she's sort of more sort of a fairy godmother type than just a fairy. She actually is one of the only characters that's in every act. Even the king and queen aren't in act two, they're in acts, the prologue at one, and you know, because she's sort of guiding the whole story. So yeah, she's definitely up there.
We'll come back to the here and now a little later on, But as I mentioned, we are in London. This podcast is about people with a Somerset connection, and yours is that you're born there.
Yeah. So I was born in Bath. My parents moved down from Yorkshire for my dad's work to Wiltshire, Chippenham area. And so I grew up around there and started dancing around there. And
you have a younger sister as well.
Yeah.
Aside from dancing, which we'll spend a lot of time on, what did the two of you get up to as kids?
I mean, we were definitely quite active kids. My mum took us to all sorts of things. You know, we did gymnastics and obviously different types of dancing. It wasn't just ballet. We did tap and jazz and all of that jazz. we were very active kids. And I think, you know, my mum always did her everything to, you know, get us out there and exposed to all different things. So, yeah.
And as siblings, do you have kind of quite similar personalities?
I think, and I guess this is because in the context of my whole life, you know, I left home when I was 11. And so naturally, I think we then had very different upbringings, just because I was brought up more in a boarding school and my sister was brought up at home. So I think even if I was brought up at home, we would have had different personalities. But I think that kind of experience definitely molded us very differently, naturally, I think would happen to anyone, I think. So there are lots of similarities we have, but definitely big differences as well.
There is some history of dancing in your family as well, isn't
there? Yeah. So I think we were talking about this the other weekend, actually. Like, my great-grandmother was like she was the head of some kind of dance troupe thing, and definitely was very theatery dance and things like that. And then my auntie, so my dad's sister, so still that side of the family, she trained in ballet and trained at the ROD, Royal Academy of Dance, and went over to Germany to dance. And is still over there. She did ballet, but also transitioned into musical theatre. And her husband that she married was in musical theatre and stuff. So we very much grew up with that as quite a big influence on us as children. And with my cousin, every summer or Christmas that we were together, we would do dance shows. And I obviously always did ballet, and Jen, my sister, always did jazz and modern stuff and things. And so I think that influence was always there, but I definitely wouldn't say that it was like a driving force. Like, it wasn't like, oh, you should do this. It was just something that naturally sort of happened. Like, I don't remember anyone ever saying to me like, oh, you should do ballet. Like, ballet should be your career, should be your job. It was just something that I was allowed to do and explore.
So you mentioned that was on your father's side.
Yes.
Are there any other characteristics or traits that you've picked up from him?
he's definitely not, didn't get the dancing gene, but he's definitely very passionate, driven person, I would say. And I definitely think I inherited that from him. He's an avid sports enthusiast, and you know, has played sports in his life and things like that, like lots of guys would do at school and things. And he supports Bath rugby, actually, but football is Leeds because he was from there. But yeah, I would say I definitely inherited that from him.
Up and down the country, every weekend after school, thousands of children are going off to dance classes from quite a young age.
Yeah.
And that was the case for you. Tell me what you can remember about those first, I don't want to use the, well, I use the pun, steps.
Yeah.
in your journey.
When I think back to those times, I remember the school fetes and the shows that we used to do, and like being on stage and performing. But I guess when I think about it more, it's more that I remember that of being part of a community, being part of a, a particular school and having your friends that you made at ballet class kind of thing that were maybe separate from school and things like that. So I guess more of that side of it. And I definitely, as a young kid, had other interests as well. It wasn't that I was like, this is all I want to do, I don't want to do anything else. But I must have enjoyed it, otherwise, you know, I'm sure I would have said to my mum, I don't want to go anymore, you know, that kind of thing. So I obviously had huge enjoyment to keep going as long as I did and have. So
I saw another interview that you did. It was sort of part of that journey that your teachers began to give you positive feedback and say, you know, actually, you are really good and you should take this to the next level.
Yeah.
When you heard that, did that stoke any ambition, or was it more of a case of, I'll just carry on and see how far this goes?
Yeah, I think, interestingly, even though, you know, as we said before, that we did have some dance sort of connections in our family, which some people have absolutely nothing and it comes out of thin air, seems to, kind of thing. Like, my parents very much, I don't think any of us ever thought that I was going to be what I am today. So I think in that positive feedback that we got, I was always encouraged by my mum, you know, and dad to just give it a go. The first bit of feedback I got was in an exam, like a RAD exam, I think it was. They used to have a comment section. I'm not sure they do anymore, but like, you know, you'd have your marks and then your comment section. And in the comment section, the examiner said that she thought I should audition for JAs, which is a program around the country that filters into the Royal Ballet School. So they're like little outreach things around the country. And, you know, I remember going to the audition and my mum always saying, it's just good to have experience of doing these things and that kind of thing. There was never any sort of like, oh, well, what if you get in or what if you don't get in? Or like, it was always very much geared at like, just have a go. I don't have like sort of any memory of being like, oh God, I went to an audition, so scary. Like, we just went, you know, and had a go. And I don't think there was ever any expectation of that this is something I should do or you have to do this kind of thing. So yeah, I definitely have quite nice positive memories of that time. And luckily for me, I did get into JAs and so on and so on. So yeah. It was, yeah.
Where you are now, you must have colleagues and friends that perhaps had a very different experience of getting into ballet, the art. Do you ever reflect on that as a sort of positivity difference, and maybe how you approach what you're doing now versus how your friends and colleagues with a different background, how they maybe approach things now?
Yeah, I think on paper, you would say I had a very easy journey. You know, I auditioned for JAs, got into JAs, auditioned for White Lodge, got into White Lodge, auditioned for Upper School, got into Upper School, got offered a job in the Royal Ballet, like climbed the ranks, things like that. But I think every dancer, whatever your journey has been or is, and as easy as some parts may seem, it is not an easy career or ride for anyone. There's always different times in growing up where you feel differently about things, or your body changes in different ways to other people, or you experience times of working really hard and not feeling like you're getting rewarded. Or it's a very, very difficult career in the sense that it's not like, oh, I did this performance and I got a medal to say that I was best in the world. Somebody could watch your show and be like, oh, I really didn't enjoy that. And somebody else might be, that's the best show I've ever seen. Mm. It's so subjective in that way that there's no one way of really making it. Even though we have like superstars, you know, Darcy Bustle, Marinella, like these people, like there may be some people out there that have other dancers that they prefer or that they enjoy more watching. Mm. It's just, everyone's entitled to their own opinion in that way. So, yeah, there's weighs that kind of factor to it.
I'd like to explore that in a little bit more a little bit later on. Yeah. But you mentioned White Lodge.
Yes.
Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, White Lodge. I mean, if sometimes when I think, when I have my own children one day, the thought of letting them go at 11 years old to move into some old royal's premises in the middle of Richmond Park in London, like to train to be a ballet dancer, I'm like, what? It's crazy. And I think my parents took it very seriously in, it wasn't just a life choice for me, it was a life choice for our entire family, you know, including my sister, because the oldest sibling in the family was gonna move away, basically. And I think they really had to think about whether it was something that they thought was worth it. And I think as much as it, they obviously asked me if I wanted to go, if they had thought that it wasn't a good thing to do, then I probably wouldn't have gone. Because I wasn't also like, please, 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 I really want to go, I want to be a ballerina. Like, I wasn't at that age. So it was just something that came about, kind of thing. So it is a big, you know, decision. But for me, I loved it. And, you know, I made some of the best friends that I, you know, I'm still friends with today, even though we're all in different walks of life and doing different things. And I did have moments of being homesick, and my way of coping was to not go home, which definitely had its impact on my relationship with my family. I found it easier to emotionally remove myself from that and just be there and join in the fun that happened at weekends and that kind of thing. That was my way of coping, you know, which I've definitely had to assess in later life. But for all the maybe sad or like negative things that may have come about in those times, there were just as if not more positive things that I felt like I got out of going to boarding school in the middle of Richmond Park.
I read in another interview that you sort of said it is easier to stay because if you go home or if you see your family, it's like you're reminded of that life, and it's much easier just to be like, that's not a thing for this weekend. I'm here, and that's
And it was such a limited amount of time, really. Like, we would have stuff till like maybe 1 o'clock on the Saturday for my parents, or to get home it was like two and a bit hour drive to get up, then that to get back. I would literally get there, have dinner, go to sleep, and then think about driving back the next day. And because we were in the middle of Richmond Park during the winter, the gate shut at 4 o'clock. So you had to either be in, or there was this horrendous thing that I did once and never wanted to do it again, where they would put a minibus at Richmond Station at 7:30. And I remember doing it once, and it was just awful because there was all these parents of all these kids, and all the kids were crying and like didn't want to go. And I was just like, this is horrible. I am not going to do this again. I will just either stay, or you have to bring me back before the gate shut, because, you know, it was just traumatizing, this seeing this experience of kids being put onto a minibus and like parents and kids crying, and you're just like, so yeah, I definitely found it much easier to just be removed.
Is it true that you actually forgot all your kit for the audition?
Yes, we were talking about this the other day. I think it was, I can't remember, I would have to check with my mum whether it was the J audition or the White Lodge audition, but I'm pretty sure it was the White Lodge audition. But yeah, I forgot all my stuff, and like we were running late, which is not like any of my family. And I guess it was one of those things where it was like, get in the car, we're running late. Da, da, da. And yeah, so then one of my friends that was at JA's with me that was auditioning as well, I borrowed all of her stuff. And my mum was, I'm sure she was like, I mean, there's no way we're getting in now. but yeah, so it was.
Through the world of film and TV, I think us outsiders are led to believe that ballet school is a fiercely competitive place. It's full of backstabbing and everyone hates each other. Yes. I'm sure that's not the case, is it?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't my experience. I mean, maybe I'm naive and the situation that I was in was not like that, and maybe other year groups it was or whatever. But I mean, at like 11 years old, I just don't think you have the capacity to really understand what you're even fighting against, because you're all so young, you've got no parents or siblings around you. Obviously, there's times where there might feel like there's some favouritism or someone always gets the main part or like blah, blah, blah. But I guess in my head, I always just was sort of like, well, if they are better or they are improving better or they're, you know, then that's why they're getting to do those things. And I think, you know, it's also 11 to 16 is especially for women, but obviously for men as well, is a huge time in your life that you change. There was some people that would join at 11 and were like 4 foot something and left, and they were like 5 foot 10. And other people joined and they were like 4 foot 2 and left, and they were 4 foot 9. I don't even know how they pick at that age. I mean, there's obviously certain things, flexibility, da 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 da, but I just don't even know how you know, because the array of talent in different areas is just so huge. And it's, yeah, I wouldn't be able to do it, so.
During that time, as well as the physical change that people go through, there's obviously the mental change, and you sort of have to work out who you are as a person. At the same time, you're still supporting and being involved in productions. You know, there's the kids' roles in The Nutcracker and being a baby swan and that kind of thing. Did you feel like naturally confident just going on stage and doing that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I guess there must be some statistic around like the age that kids in general find that like fear factor, because lots of, you know, quite young kids, you notice that they just will like run off the edge of a bus, like, oh, not really knowing what they're doing. And I think, I guess sort of around that age, 9, 10, 11, like you start to become more aware of yourself. And I definitely remember we used to go to this big outdoor park, Bow Wood, and I, at one point, was like, I can't go on these things anymore. They scare me too much. This is too high. The slide's too deep. And my sister was like, whoa, this is so fun. Like, you know, still. And I remember that kind of creeping in, but not with stage stuff, I guess, because that was just what we all did. I don't remember there sort of being, I mean, obviously there's always a nerve factor. I think that's normal in any form of performing, or like, I'm sure, footballers or like athletes, you know, there's always like an element of nervousness or, you know, anticipation and that kind of thing. And I definitely had that, but there wasn't ever a moment where I like didn't want to go on the stage or was like, oh, I don't want to do this. All of those parts, like being the children in Nutcracker, and it was just so exciting to be surrounded by all these raw ballet company dancers, and you just like felt like you were in this little bubble, so consumed by like getting your Christmas present and opening it up and showing your designated mum and dad in the nut. Like, you didn't feel like there was thousands of people out there watching you, you know. And even like the Baby Swans part, we had to come on with whoever was Odette O'Deal, like Darcy Bustle, Sylvie Guillier, Miyako Shida, like, and they would turn to us sometimes and be like, I don't really know when to go on, so will you just tell me when we're going? And we'd be like, oh my gosh. You felt like you were part of the production. You didn't feel alone on the stage. That comes later.
Claire, you're anticipating some of my questions really well on this, which is great. I know that you were, and you mentioned you're quite sporty and into sports at school. And as you said, that's an area where people talk a lot about the mental side of performance.
Yeah.
When you get into the high ranks of tennis, everyone's like, well, it's just a mental game now. But at least, again, from an outsider's perspective, in the world of performing arts, it doesn't really kind of translate in exactly the same way, does it? And I think having done sports and sort of talking about it as a parallel, is a really interesting one. I'm keen to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, it's such a fine line, because we're as much athletes as the next athlete that runs or swims or anything. Like, we have to train our bodies to be able to do very specific things. But like I said earlier, there is also a theatrical acting side to what we do, which to, you know, majority of the audience members don't have a clue what we're meant to be doing technically. So what they're there to see is the performance side of it. So you could go on and do the most technically amazing performance, but if you're not telling the story and you're not portraying the right things, people aren't, they're going to be like, what's going on here? Whereas the same, really, I guess, when you watch someone run, you know, my mum all the time would be like, oh, they've got a funny run, but they're winning golds at, you know, but it doesn't matter how that is. And that's the thing for us, is we have that dual aspect to what we do. And I guess one of the things for me that definitely there was a point that I was like, this is what I want to do. And the part that I did enjoy was the physicality side of it and the work side and getting stronger and improving. That's definitely something that I was drawn to with doing ballet.
Is there a point you reach as a dancer where it's not about the steps and it's more instinctive, you know what you're doing, and it's more nuanced than I do this and then I do this and then I do this?
Yeah, definitely. Like, say when I do Lilac Fairy now, I'm not really thinking about the steps, because the steps happen. I think about how they feel technically, like if I feel like on my leg or if I, but I'm not thinking step, releve, tombe, pas de bourrée, penché, arabesque. I'm not thinking that. But I think there are probably very few dancers, but there are some, that are able to leave that side behind. And they are the people that you watch on stage and you just think, oh, they're that character. You're just totally taken away from the fact that they're even dancing, almost, because you're so just involved with what they're portraying as a performance. But it's hard to do with some ballet things, because it is also about the steps that you're doing. So it is a tricky thing to juggle. But yeah, there's always, you have to be, you can't just float off to thinking about what you're having for dinner. But there is that sweet spot where it is happening naturally and you can just be in the moment of what you're doing, rather than thinking, oh no, is this going to work? Is that going to work? So yeah, there is definitely a lot of mental aspect that goes on there, for sure.
Talk me through how you were feeling the first time you danced the Lilac Fairy.
It's quite a long time back now, but I was, I was definitely excited, and I worked a lot on it. Monica Mason, who was the director at the time, and it is also her production. You do not go on stage not prepared to do things. You're doing it from halfway through and then running it from the top straight away. Like, so, you know, I knew that I could do it. The thing I would say that's like evolved more is how I portray the character. And, you know, you have a very, very difficult solo in the prologue, but then the rest of it, you're kind of just doing mime and telling the story and things like that. And I think that's the part that actually has progressed and changed the most, and the part that I've also really grown to love doing as well.
Going back to something you mentioned earlier around the subjectivity of it, because obviously when you're in the sort of school and the formal part of it, you've got exams and you kind of keep going and you sort of go further and further up the pyramid. And I'm assuming that some people will leave the yeah. profession at various points. But once you're through that and once you're, you know, in the company, it's not like you're being objectively scored.
Yeah.
So what kind of perspective do you have to try and have on where you're going, your trajectory, the roles you're getting, the roles you're not getting?
Yeah, I guess, like, It's, again, it's like such an individualized thing. And also, I've had two different directors. You know, I started with Monica Mason and now I have Kevin O'Hare. And I almost see them as like two separate parts of my career, because they're two different people making two different decisions about what rep I should do and where my career is going and things like that. So, and there's will be some people, not that many now, but people in the company that would have had three maybe directors. And you know, you might have one director that loves you and then another director that's like, oh, I just don't see you like that. So it's a big, can be a big change. But I think, you know, a lot of very talented dancers join the Royal Ballet Company because it's one of the best companies in the world, and they get first pickings usually of the best or most talented dancers. You know, some directors might pick really top level dancers that they just want to stay in the core, but they also might pick people that they're going to want to move up the ranks as well. So it can be like quite a difficult time when you first join and trying to work out not only sort of where you fit in within the company, but also how you're going to prove yourself or how you're going to find out where you sit and what you want to do, and whether you, you know, there would definitely be people that think they want to do solos and things like that, and then maybe get a chance to do it and are like, oh no, like that's too much pressure for me. I'm happy in the core. I want to, being the corps de ballet and the Royal Ballet is like a mega, mega thing. When you come and watch a performance, you know, the principals can be as amazing as they usually are as principal dancers. But if everything around the side and all those ballets that have like, you know, like Swan Lake, like the 24 swans, like it's incredible watching that many people doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. And I think it should be a really valued position within the company. So I definitely felt like I wanted to take that very seriously, as much as I wanted to take seriously that I wanted to do more. And so I think it's finding that, just wanting to keep striving to be better.
You talked a little earlier around the ups and downs and how it's not just all plain sailing. It's not sort of you start here, you end at the top, and that's it. Twice in your career, you've had to come back from quite serious injuries as well. Yeah. What can you share about that experience?
Yeah, with my, I had, knee surgery like a bit over 10 years ago now, which was, I guess I was sort of, because I hadn't really had anything major, I was sort of quite naive to the situation, in the sense of like, I was obviously devastated, firstly, that I was going to have surgery, but I was like, sort of, I kind of took it as a like, right, I'm going to come back better, stronger, I'm going to focus on this. I was like, I really got like in the zone. And although it was a big injury, they foresaw that I was going to be out for at least a year, and I was back on stage in 9 months, which I think is pretty good going. And not just walking around, I was doing a really hard role, lots of jumping, like stamina, like, you know, it was. And after that, I didn't sort of, haven't had any problems sort of since. And like, you know, I feel like it was quite a like triumph story of a like, but it definitely taught me a lot about myself and my body. And I was able to sort of have a reset time, which you don't really, from when you join, there isn't any time to like, what would I like to improve on? Like, blah, blah, because it's just go all the time. Like, there's no sort of self-reflection time. You know, you finish a show and you're up the next day doing something else. And there's not always a lot of time to savor moments or like really reflect on things. But then last year I had a very freak moment of, we were getting ready for Chazelle and I'd had my stage call that week of Queen of the Willies, which is like one of the hardest roles that you can ever do in ballet. And the day of the show, I did a releve and I felt this like almost like firework go off in my calf, and I tore my calf. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, I'm strong, I'm fit. How did I tear my calf? Like, that's just, this doesn't make any sense to me. And anyway, they said it was just a grade one tear, which I was like, you know, that's not big tear. Like, so should 4 weeks, you know, you can sort of start doing things again. And so I was kind of like building back up, and I had no symptoms. I was like, this is weird. Like, I feel good. Bam, 4 weeks later, I re-tore it again. And it just really messed with my head, because I was like, I was doing all this like testing, and my calf was like, I could push 3 times my body weight through my calf, but it was still torn. And I was like, this does not make any sense to me. Like, I don't understand how you can be like really fit and strong and tear your calf. But these are just things that happen. It's just like accidents. It's sort of, and yeah, so I kind of struggled a bit mentally, like coming back from that. I felt very nervous that, well, if it can happen then, why is it not just gonna happen now? It took me a long time to sort of get past that. It was also quite a big season, because towards the end of that season, I was going to debut in Odette O'Deal, which is literally my dream, ever dream role to ever do. And I only had one show, so I had one chance. And I think a lot of that was playing in my mind even from the beginning of the season. And so when this happened, I was like, this is like, you know, this is not the right time. I do not need this right now. I need to. So I managed to sort of get it together for the show, but I was still having like weird symptoms. And the day that after the show, I woke up and I didn't feel anything, like, again, basically. So there was a lot of like head stuff that I think was sort of triggering feelings in, like it was a whole thing. But it was just a very different injury to the injury I had before. Like, I would have said, I mean, tearing your calf is not career ending. People do things like that all the time. Whereas when a piece of bone and cartilage fell off my knee, that could have been career ending. But somehow this one just really messed with my head so much more. And so I've done, again, like quite a lot of work on sort of why that was and what that was sort of attached to. And so, yeah, that might do. Interesting injuries.
That unique experience as life as a dancer is something that few others understand.
Yeah.
Do you think that makes for part of the foundation in terms of the relationship that you have with your husband?
Yeah, I think so. I think being the type of person that I am, on top of being a ballet dancer, and similarly the type of person that my husband is, as much as we may have had this idea of that we wanted to be with someone that was nothing to do with ballet, because, you know, that makes you a more rounded person and, you know, you have that other aspect. I mean, I, you know, for the whole, you know, my whole career, I've been so focused on ballet. There wasn't really much time for anything else. And lots of people don't always really get that and sort of might be like, oh, but you just go in and do shows. You know, like, no, I don't just go in and do shows. It's like a whole, oh, do you want to go out for dinner tonight? Oh, no, because it might be a bit late and I've got this tomorrow. Or like, you know, your whole life is just, being a ballet dancer is a lifestyle. It's not just a hobby that you do and you do some shows in the evenings and that's it. So I think, you know, we very much respect what each other does and what we have to do what we do on stage. And so, yeah, it definitely helps our relationship.
Let's talk a bit about 2022.
Yeah.
So after recovering from your calf tear,
yeah,
you danced Odette O'Deal.
Yeah.
You got married.
Yeah.
And you danced my little girl's favourite role, the Sugar Plum Fairy, in the Nutcracker.
Yeah.
And you're also renovating your home.
Yes.
So quite an intense year.
Yes.
For you.
Very intense. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, off the back of COVID, where felt like the world stopped for like almost 2 years, we had a lot to fit in. Yeah, so we have actually just finished phase two of the renovations. We put a loft on what the first part we did was downstairs, and then now we've put the loft on. But I have to say, I will be glad when it's all done, because it is quite stressful. Obviously stress we put on ourselves, but having builders in your house and all of that is a lot. But yeah, we've done a lot. And yeah, we got married in August. It was hands down the best day of my life, which is pretty nice to say. I would say we had a pretty stress-free wedding, which was great. You know, my husband's Australian, so everyone that needed to get over managed to get over. And so it was... yeah, very special.
I was thinking there must have been some quite big expectations around your first dance.
I know. Everyone said this. They were like, I was like, we only dance if we're getting paid, okay? So, you know, we just did the like obligatory rocking from side to side to the song that we picked, and that was it. There was no way I was going to be doing any dirty dancing lifts or anything like that.
Let's take the maybe the second best day then, your Swan Lake performance.
Yeah.
Can you explain to me why that is sort of the ultimate role for a dancer?
I guess it's because it, for me anyway, it embodies everything that you need to be able to do to be a ballerina. It has a dual role for a start, so you have two characters sort of to play in one show, and it's also technically really hard. It has the famous 32 fouettés, and the difference in dynamic of each of the two characters as well, and there's so much scope for different people to play it differently as well. So, you know, you have to find your way. And you get to be a swan. I don't know what it is about being a swan for me that is just so magical. Like, I just love it.
You mentioned it is two characters that you have to play, and not just two characters, they're sort of two polar opposite characters. So what was different about the way in which you prepare to sort of get into and portray those characters when you have to do two at the same time?
Yeah, I guess... I actually had, when I was doing it, had this big revelation, which isn't really a revelation because it's just what it is, but I was like, had this moment of that, you know, Odette, she is a princess, but she's been turned into a swan. So she's actually a swan. Whereas Odile is a princess pretending to be a swan. So there's certain aspects of what Odile would do that are still very like, normal classical, so like rounded arms and not wafting swan arms, because she's not actually a swan, but then she does things to emulate, but it still wouldn't be sort of quite the same, or sort of not done as well, but there's that aspect of that she's playing something rather than, whereas with Odette you have to find that feeling of that your arms are wings, that you're not actually human kind of thing. So that was kind of the take that I took on it. So with the Odile stuff, I could really just be like, okay, this is pure classical. I'm doing ballet steps, but putting these bits on top. Whereas with Odette, you know, you have to do much more work to make it not look like you're a ballet dancer almost, that you are, or that you're not even human, that you are a swan. So that was the kind of train of thought I went with for sort of trying to find the difference between the two. But everyone has their different takes on it as well. So that's what's so interesting about seeing different people do it. I watch lots of videos and stuff like that as well.
Did you have time to savour the moment when you're in the performance, or did it sort of become quite overwhelming of, you know, this is what I've been building up to in my career for forever?
I did actually. I really tried to be in the moment. There was, you know, there's the very famous entrance where like all the swans run off and there's like this rumbling and you jump and like land almost like on one leg and have to stay still, and the music like stops, and then there's like applause usually, which there was because I had lots of friends and family in the audience. And I managed to sort of like, I was very sort of concentrated on that bit, and there's some like balances and there's like a light in your face and you're like, oh God. But it was at the end of the act two pas de deux, the applause, like it made me well up and I was like, oh no, I have to like keep it in, because I could just feel all the people out there that like, it felt almost, this sounds like, I don't know, it probably sounds really awful to some people, but it felt like everyone was there just to watch me. Like it was like this really important moment that everyone needed to see. And like, so I was like, okay, I have to like, and I really had to take a moment to like keep it in. But then at the end, I couldn't keep it in. And I was very emotional. And yeah, it was a very special performance for me, especially.
Is it something you'd do again?
I mean, there is a small part of me that's like, maybe that was just good to just do that one show and there's no other. But of course, I would love to do it again. I would love to do it every day, but that's not possible. But yeah, I'm not sure when it's due to come back. So yeah, we'll see.
Before we wrap up, one slightly random question, mm-hmm. bringing us back to Somerset, where we started. A couple of years ago, you performed at Yeo Valley.
Yes.
Are there any plans to do anything like that again in the future, or do we have to come to London and see you?
Yeah, I don't know. I would hope so. It was actually off the back of a couple of galas that we did in the south of France, and because of COVID and stuff, it was difficult to get out there. And so this Yeo Valley thing popped up, and it, from what I know, it was a very successful event, and yeah, I would hope that we would do something like that again, but I haven't heard anything as of yet, but I will let you know if I do.
Claire, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely chatting to you. Where can people find out more about what's going on with you personally and with the company as well?
Yeah, I guess the Royal Opera House website has most things that you need to know about what's going on. So yeah, I would start there first.
You've been a wonderful guest. Thank you for sharing your
story. Thank you very much. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. If you liked it, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on social media at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. Somerset Stories is a Whitstone production, and music is provided by Jezzar under Creative Commons.